ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Thursday, the 13th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, an end to the longest shutdown in US history. And Aurora Australis lights up the southern skies.
It's incredible to be able to see it, you know, in our lifetime.
It's really pretty.
Yeah, we've never actually been out and seen it before. So happy we got to see it this time.
Your jaw drops every time you see one. Just absolutely beautiful. Just an array of colours and shapes. Yeah, I love it. You know, you're sort of hooked.
The Liberal Party has formally dumped its commitment to achieving net zero emissions by 2050. The party's shadow cabinet met this morning to endorse the party's new stance after a majority of Liberal MPs and senators spoke out against retaining the target at a closed-door party room meeting yesterday. The ABC understands the party will retain its commitment to the Paris Agreement, an international treaty which aims to reduce global warming. But will this new policy setting see an exodus of Liberal members from the front bench? Rachel Mealy reports.
Net zero by 2050 is no longer a part of the Liberal Party's policy platform. Shadow Cabinet met today and agreed to scrap the commitment from the party's Climate Change Act and also repeal Labor's 2030 emissions reduction target. Senator Dave Sharma is a moderate voice in the Liberal Party and has been a supporter of keeping the net zero commitment. He spoke to Sky News before today's shadow cabinet and says he's happy to argue for the party's new position.
So I'm a member of a political party, Peter. I'm not an independent, which means that I will go and argue my views within the party room about what I think is in the best interests of us as a political movement, but more importantly, what is in the best national interests of Australia. And I respect that my colleagues may have different views, may have the same views, but whatever the party ultimately decides and the shadow ministry ultimately decides, I'm a team player.
Dave Sharma foreshadowed that the party would retain its commitment to the Paris Climate Accords.
The Paris Agreement commits the entire world to aim for net zero as a global goal, if you like, or balancing of emissions and sinks by the second half of this century. And it also commits countries to submit five-yearly targets for emissions reduction. So Australia will remain part of that process under a coalition.
The outcome of today's meeting followed yesterday's wider meeting of Liberal MPs and senators. South Australian Liberal Senator Andrew McLaughlin spoke at yesterday's meeting in favour of retaining the net zero targets. He believes dumping net zero will make it harder for the party to win seats at the next election.
But I don't see how you can go to the electorate and say, well, we've committed to net zero 2050 since Scott Morrison days, and now we think it's a bad idea. And I think we owe it to the nation that we are equally committed, but we have different ideas about how to get there.
He says a new policy would be interpreted negatively by voters who want to see climate action.
I think the community want us to show a passion and motivation to leave the world in a better place. And from that, our policy should unfold. And I think if you can't show that motivation or that integrity of thought, it's a major factor in how they cast their vote.
If the Liberal Party can't win those city seats, can you then therefore not win government again?
Well, that's mathematics, so I have to agree with you. I think you should be appealing to all Australians no matter where they live. You should be, and that is what you should do so you can formulate policies, build a government in the national interest.
But Western Sydney MP Melissa McIntosh sees it differently. At yesterday's meeting, she argued that dumping net zero would provide cost of living relief to people in her electorate who are doing it tough.
I went into the party room yesterday really strong in my conviction on behalf of my community when it comes to dropping net zero, and it was never about anti-climate or anti-environment. It was pro-reality and people in the suburbs. It's literally survival in the suburbs. They're dying under the pressure of the Albanese Labor government's missed targets when it comes to emissions reduction.
She says a new policy would be seen as a new path for voters to choose.
It's not about winning back vote. So it's around protecting Australians and creating a better life for them in their future. And if they want to vote for us and they can see we're creating a better path, well, that's the ultimate outcome. Of course, we want to return to government.
The Labor Party is watching the Liberal Party's debate from the sidelines. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says a new climate policy would hurt Australians.
The Coalition are choosing to take Australia backwards. They're walking away from jobs for Australians and investment certainty for business. Have no doubt the Coalition approach would hurt Australians. It would lead to less investment, less reliability, less jobs, less economic growth.
Parallel to the Liberal Party's decision about its net zero policy is the leadership question hanging over Susan Lee. Asked if she'll be the leader to take a new policy to the next election, Liberal Senator Dave Sharma had this to say.
I don't have a crystal ball, but Susan's leadership is secure, and as far as I'm aware, there are no challenges.
Liberal Senator Dave Sharma ending that report by Rachel Mealy. The longest government shutdown in US history has finally ended. Lawmakers have voted through a package to end the 43-day standoff, which paralysed Washington and left hundreds of thousands of workers unpaid.
On this vote, the yeas are 222, the nays are 209. The bill is passed. The motion is adopted.
The package doesn't include any updates on the healthcare subsidies that were one of the primary demands by the Democrats. Meanwhile, the Democrats have applied more pressure on President Donald Trump, releasing emails about his relationship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, who wrote that Mr. Trump, quote, knew about the girls. Nicole Johnston has more.
Donald Trump is being dogged by the saga of Jeffrey Epstein. At the heart of it is this question. Did the president know about Mr. Epstein's alleged sex trafficking network of underage girls? Mr. Trump insists he did not. Now Democrats have released emails between Mr. Epstein and his associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, who is serving a 20-year prison sentence in Texas for conspiring in child sex trafficking. In one email from 2011, Mr. Epstein wrote,
I want you to realise that the dog that hasn't barked is Trump.
The name is then redacted. The email goes on to say,
spent hours at my house with him.
The White House says the missing name was victim Virginia Giuffre, who died earlier this year and has never accused the president of misconduct. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
These emails prove absolutely nothing other than the fact that President Trump did nothing wrong. And what President Trump has always said is that he was from Palm Beach and so was Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein was a member at Mar-a-Lago until President Trump kicked him out because Jeffrey Epstein was a pedophile and he was a creep. And this email you refer to with the name of a victim that was unredacted now and has since been reported on in this room, so I will go ahead and say it, Virginia Giuffre.
The Democrats insist Mr. Trump did know more than he has let on, with a vote to release all the files expected next week. California Democrat Ro Khanna.
Today there were bombshell emails that came out showing that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell had emails about Donald Trump's knowledge of what was going on. So we need a full release of the files.
What happened next is even more striking. After the email drop, the Republicans published 20,000 pages of new Epstein files, accusing the Democrats of cherry-picking in their email leak. Investigators and newsrooms are now combing through the contents. But as for the emails, Mitchell Ebner says so far there is no smoking gun. The Republicans say, though, that these emails prove that President Trump did nothing wrong.
Well, they don't. I mean, it's just that simple. These emails, the vast majority of them do not address this question at all. And the ones that are relevant raise suspicions. They don't create a final, beyond a reasonable doubt, position with regard to Donald Trump having done something wrong.
Today was meant to be all about the House of Representatives voting to end the 43-day US government shutdown. The Epstein drama has overshadowed it. But the funding bill has finally been passed. President Trump has said he will sign it. That would finally end the longest-running shutdown in US history.
Nicole Johnston there. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has taken the extraordinary step of writing to Israel's president, urging him to pardon the country's prime minister over charges of corruption. The US president says Benjamin Netanyahu should be allowed to govern his country into a new era without his attention being diverted to the long-running trial, which President Trump and Mr. Netanyahu's supporters frequently refer to as a witch hunt. Here's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran.
Donald Trump is known for his fairly blunt assessments, and he's left the world with little doubt of his views on the corruption allegations facing the Israeli Prime Minister.
Cigars and champagne, who the hell cares about that?
That was during his speech to the Israeli Parliament, the Knesset, last month, days after the fragile ceasefire in Gaza came into force.
Hey, I have an idea. Mr. President, why don't you give him a pardon?
He's now taken that pitch a step further, putting his thick black pen to paper in an impassioned pitch for that pardon. The president describing Mr. Netanyahu as a formidable and decisive wartime prime minister, now leading Israel into a time of peace after a terribly difficult 3 years. Donald Trump says he absolutely respects the independence of the Israeli judicial system, but believes the case against Bibi, as Mr. Netanyahu is known, is a political and unjustified prosecution.
He's a very talented guy.
The US president hinted more advocacy for the prime minister could be coming during an interview with US network CBS earlier this month.
We'll be involved in that to help him out a little bit because I think it's very unfair.
In response to the letter, President Isaac Herzog said he holds President Trump in the highest regard, but added there are processes which need to be followed for any presidential pardon to be considered.
This letter is extremely problematic on many levels, but this is Trump, and everybody seems to go along with it because it is Trump.
Professor Yoav Dotan is a former Dean of Law at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem.
So even if President Herzog decides to pardon Netanyahu following Trump's letter, which I doubt, his decision would be subject to judicial review by the court.
Benjamin Netanyahu was first charged in 2019, accused of bribery, fraud and breach of trust, all of which he rejects. While one of the charges is based on accepting expensive gifts from billionaires, including Australian James Packer, who denies any wrongdoing, the other charges relate to seeking favourable press coverage from media moguls in exchange for legislative and regulatory changes to benefit their businesses. The day before the Prime Minister began giving evidence in his trial, he was defiant.
For 8 years, I've been waiting to expose the system, this brutal witch hunt. These investigations were born in sin.
There isn't a strong legal precedent in Israel for such an intervention while a trial is underway. Mr. Netanyahu's political opponents argue he could only be pardoned if he admits guilt or shows remorse, something he's never done in this case and rarely does in public life. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for The World Today.
Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Back home now, and a treaty between First Nations people and the government of Victoria has been signed into law today, marking the first such agreement in Australia's history. Advocates say they believe it will help improve outcomes for First Nations people in the state. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
An historic moment, generations in the making. After 237 years, Australia has a formal treaty agreement with First Nations people. The treaty between the Victorian government and the state's Aboriginal people was signed into law this morning at an event at Government House in Melbourne on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. Ngaira Murray is the co-chair of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria and a signatory to the treaty.
Today marks a turning point in our nation's history, a moment where old wounds can begin to heal and new relationships can be built on truth, justice and mutual respect.
She says Victoria is on the right side of history.
The signing of this treaty and the granting of royal assent is more than ceremony, it is recognition and renewal. It is a promise that the future will be written together.
treaty enshrines an independent statutory body known as Gelung Wal that will be consulted on laws affecting Aboriginal people. Under treaty, the democratically elected consultative body, the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, will become permanent and ongoing. There'll also be a body for independent oversight to monitor government progress on improving outcomes for Aboriginal people, as well as a body to coordinate truth-telling and reconciliation. Nerita Waite is the Chief Executive of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service and a treaty negotiator.
I just hope that it is that lasting impact and the transformation that our communities have been desiring since first contact.
She says treaty allows for First Nations consultation on policy.
And that is done by a number of ways. One is the treaty provides for guidelines to be established between departments so that Aboriginal experts can get in on policy development at the very early stages. The second is that at any point in which time a bill is provided to Parliament, it must be assessed for treaty compatibility and the First Peoples must be notified and have a chance to respond.
Gelung Wal will be future-proofed with a special appropriation act to be set up by Parliament, and the body will receive tens of millions of dollars per year once fully operational. Victorian opposition leader Brad Batten says if his party is successful at next year's election, they'll scrap treaty.
We opposed it the whole way through the chambers, and we said that within the first 100 days we will introduce legislation to repeal the treaty. We've been pretty strict on this. We don't need another layer of government, and the money that it's going to cost to operate the program total for treaty is going to cost billions of dollars. That money would be better invested in closing the gap for Indigenous people across the state, and we think that should be where our focus is. We would also have our First Nations Victoria, so make sure that there's a very strong voice still within government.
RMIT School of Law lecturer and human rights lawyer Dr. Jeremy Bracker says treaty does not create another level of government, nor does it diminish parliamentary powers.
What this does is builds on a participatory democracy where Indigenous voices will help inform, shape public decisions, but parliamentary sovereignty, untouched, remains intact. The government of the day will always be able to pass its laws, regardless of what Indigenous people say or don't say. It's just giving them a say.
Dr. Bracker says he expects outcomes relating to areas such as health and justice to improve under treaty.
There's a long history of Indigenous perspectives being ignored and sidelined. And when in countries like Canada or New Zealand or even Colombia, where they also have an Indigenous population, policies informed by Indigenous people, the outcomes are always better. And I think it's a really incredible landmark.
Human rights lawyer Dr. Jeremy Bracker, ending that report by Bridget Fitzgerald and Kimberly Price. Governments are spending big on housing and energy projects, according to the latest report into infrastructure investment. Over the next 4 years, governments across the country are projected to invest $242 billion in major projects. But there are worrying signs that the workforce is not keeping up. Angus Randall reports.
The Victorian town of Rokewood was home to a few hundred people until the nation's largest wind farm began construction just down the road. Helena Kirby owns the local takeaway.
Oh, all of a sudden it was massive, especially in summer. We had a booming little business, and the more people who started working at the wind farm, the more people I had to employ.
When it's finished, Golden Plains Wind Farm will have 215 turbines powering around 765,000 homes at a cost of around $3 billion, in part funded by the federal government. Figures out today from independent government advisor Infrastructure Australia show where federal, state and territory governments plan to invest. It's called the Public Infrastructure Pipeline and refers to major projects committed in Ford budgets over the next 4 years. Infrastructure Australia's chief executive is Adam Kopp.
After 2 years of a decline in the major pipeline, it has actually grown $29 billion over the past year to reach $242 billion. That's the highest level since Infrastructure Australia has been tracking the major public infrastructure pipeline. And the mix of projects after a boom of over the last 10 years of transport projects, there's definitely a shift towards housing and renewable energy.
It's not surprising these two areas have witnessed a bump in activity. They have some ambitious government targets attached. The National Housing Accord pledges to build 1.2 million new homes over the next few years, and the Renewable Energy Target Scheme aims to add 33,000 gigawatt hours of renewable power to the system each year until 2030.
It is a reflection of the targets, and you know, when you look at the recent elections right around the country, housing and energy transition are the major topics of discussion.
All this infrastructure needs workers to build it, and the report projects a shortage of 141,000 workers in related industries. Worker shortages could hit 300,000 by 2027, with regional areas hit hardest, where many of the large-scale energy projects are based. Adam Kopp says there are several ways to bring that number down.
One is looking at migration settings. So the Australian government has been looking at a skills migration framework with a particular focus on construction workers, focusing more on bringing more people into the sector, making it an attractive place to work. Unfortunately, the construction sector has what's called a leaky pipeline. So people come into the sector, but they tend not to stay.
Innes Willocks is the chief executive of the Australian Industry Group.
We're not going to achieve our national aspirations with the workforce we currently have or the way that the workforce is currently set up.
He says Australia's economy risks going backwards if it can't find ways to boost that skilled workforce.
Yeah, we're going to need to make a massive national effort around training, around education, around skills development locally, but we're also going to have to think through how we deal with skilled migration as ways to try to fill this gap. You think about housing, every trade that is involved in making a house is virtually on the critical skill shortages list at the moment, and that's going to make it very hard for us to reach our housing targets.
Federal Infrastructure Minister Catherine King has been contacted for comment.
Angus Randall. Stargazers were treated to what's been described as a spectacular light show over southern Australia last night. Photographers relished news of a severe geomagnetic storm. They were up until the early hours to capture the phenomenon known as Aurora Australis. The strength of the storm was such that it meant that it was visible even as far north as Queensland, as Tanya Dendrinos reports.
Spectacular hues of pink, purple and green danced across the sky overnight. The Aurora Australis captivating crowds at Brighton Beach in Melbourne.
It's incredible to be able to see it, you know, in our lifetime.
It's really pretty.
Yeah, we've never actually been out and seen it before, so happy we got to see it this time.
Yeah, it feels pretty amazing to see it. It's my first time seeing it in person. Pretty unbelievable, like.
This is probably my fifth time seeing it, so it's an amazing experience.
Mark Paulson is a photographer from Bendigo in Victoria. He's been chasing auroras for a decade.
Your jaw drops every time you see one. Back of camera, just absolutely beautiful, just an array of colours and shapes. The pillars, vertical pillars, which we call rays or beams. Yeah, I love it. You know, you're sort of hooked. It's one of those things that once you see it, you can't not see it. You can't miss one because every one is completely different to the next one.
He was out until 5:30 this morning and says the display didn't disappoint.
Definitely the first part of the night, first couple of hours, was absolutely spectacular. And even in Tasmania, they were getting overhead aurora.
Pursuing the perfect glimpse of the southern lights doesn't involve staying put. Mark Paulson says he can travel up to 500 kilometres in a night, chasing a clear sky.
I went down to Malmesbury last night, and then while there was a lull in the activity, I drove an hour and a half southwest of there just to get a different perspective. Astro twilight kicked in about 9:10 last night. We started to get these beautiful pink rays, beams, pillars of pink light against the blue twilight sky. Further towards the main auroral event, from my perspective in Malmesbury, Victoria, was the green arc. So probably 10 degrees in a curved arc across the horizon.
Paul Curnow, an astronomy lecturer at Adelaide Planetarium, explains the phenomenon.
Auroras are caused by energy coming away from the sun, and it's the interaction of charged particles with the Earth's upper atmosphere that causes the particles to fluoresce, and we see these as glows. And look, the sun goes through an 11-year cycle, and basically last year we were coming out of solar max, so when the sun is very, very active.
Dr. Laura Dreesen, an astronomer at the University of Sydney, says there's still a lot of activity either side of solar max.
we have the proof, right, that it's pretty unusual. We haven't really heard about this sort of thing for quite a long time. What really happened is that this one sunspot was sort of pointed in our direction. And on the 9th, 10th and 11th, it shot out these flares towards us. And because they travel different speeds, a couple of them kind of hit roughly at the same time. And then it sort of happened one after the other. So that's one of the reasons that we had this really impressive kind of geomagnetic storm.
And if you missed it overnight, experts say there's a high chance you could catch the aurora again this evening. The further south and the further away from the city lights you are, the better.
Tanya Dendrinos there, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The longest government shutdown in American history is coming to an end. Today, political scientist Charles Hunt from Boise State University on why a small group of Democrats ended up giving Donald Trump exactly what he wanted. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.